NWP Radio.
You're listening to NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project.
NWP.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today is February 1st, 2024, and we are talking with Heather Bourbeau, author of a collection of poems entitled Monarch. Heather, could we start off by just having you tell listeners a little bit about yourself? And I have to say that we have a mostly teacher listening audience, and I think they're often curious. Is poet your full-time job? I put that in air quotes, not because I think it's not a full-time job, because I want to just emphasize it. Is poet your full-time job? And if so, what's your day like as a poet?
Yeah, I think only maybe two poets in the United States are able to be poets full-time. And they're Instagram famous type poets, because even the poet laureates have, poets laureate have other full-time jobs.
Mm.
So I am a poet and a fiction writer who is a former journalist, which will probably loop back to some of what we're going to talk about today, who now works with different United Nations agencies.
That's interesting. That's a lot of things.
Yeah, so I'm not a, I would love to be a full-time poet, although I also genuinely like what pays my rent.
And it's February. What is something that everyone who knows you knows that you love?
Well, I love dancing.
Ah.
Love dancing. But I also love learning and going down rabbit holes.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly around nature and history or random 80s bands.
This is so exciting. What an exciting collection of things to know about and do. Yeah, I think that part about rabbit holes we'll probably learn a lot more about as we talk about your book. I love that. Thank you for sharing Monarch with me and agreeing to come on NWP Radio. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about this collection of poems?
Sure. Monarch is examining overlooked histories from the U.S. West that I was raised in. So California, Nevada, Oregon, and Washington, using poetry as the vehicle. I used to pitch it as a poetic memoir, but I had a reader recently write to me and use the term flash history, which I kind of
I love that. I can see how it would be a memoir, but I feel like flash history describes my experience of this set of poems. I love the structure of this book too. I don't think I've ever read a book with this particular way of organizing things. So I wonder if you could describe that to the listeners.
Sure. I also just want to go back and reiterate, or not reiterate, but explain a little bit that when I say memoir, I mean memoir of the place and less about me, although there is some me in the poetry,
right.
But just so that people understand why we're obsessing on the history of it.
Yeah. Memoir of the place I also like.
So there are the four states, mm-hmm. and each state section has 10 poems. Each of those 10 poems starts with a timeline and ends with a list poem. And in between are more what people would consider more traditional poetry, lyrical poetry.
Mm-hmm.
The timeline, I really wanted to bring people into the state section with something that I felt could look at a larger expanse of time, but also speak really specifically to that state,
mm-hmm.
and something that is very specific to my relationship to that state.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it anchors you in the contradictions of what we're taught about that state.
It definitely does. And I mean, I love timelines actually as it's like whatever, a different a subset of flash fiction maybe, or of ways to organize information. And the use as the first poem in each section was just really it really compelling to me. I thought it was fascinating. And that each section ends with the Lisp poem. I love Lisp poems, so.
Yeah, the Lisp poem I wanted. So they're also, the poems are organized in chronological order. And I wanted the more modern history to be a little bit more abstract and let the reader, through these things, these items, get a sense of what is happening in the world that they're engaging with.
Yeah. So I read poetry like a reader and a poetry reader often, but when I'm thinking about interviewing someone, particularly for this radio show, which I know a lot of teachers listen to, I often think like a teacher also in service of that preparation. And this book for me invites a lot of teacher discussion, I think. I mean, for one thing, often when I'm interviewing poets, I'm thinking from an English teacher brain. And yet this book feels like it could be a text in an English class. It could be a text in a history class, in a science class, a civics class. And even when I said this to you, I thought, this is not a question. So I guess the question is, do you agree, or have you thought about this book as a book
Yeah.
in school?
I very much wanted, these are the histories I wish I had been taught.
Hmm.
And I also, so I definitely wanted it to be brought into schools. I developed a teaching guide. I worked with educators at the late high school and early college levels to develop a teaching guide that's available through Cornerstone Press and also on my website. I also, within that teaching guide, wanted to really get students to think about what histories are chosen for them to learn and how they can see which voices aren't included. And to question it, even in my own text, what have I missed? What in this poem have I missed? Or what am I choosing to bring to the table in this conversation? And so in that sense, I really do want it, you know, it'd be great if it were taught in civics classes, because I think it does demand people to be more active participants in the learning and writing of our collective histories.
Thank you for saying that. I completely agree. And I think it's a great segue to the next question I want to ask you about, because I think in school, and I hope this isn't always true, but I think traditionally we have invited young people to write poetry about their feelings or their experiences and essays about their research or about content. And this is a collection of beautiful poems that clearly come out of research and study of a place. I wonder if you could tell us about, I mean, you can say anything you want about that noticing, but also I think people would love to hear about what was your research and writing process.
Yeah, well, to talk first to that noticing, I think if I had been 17, 18, 19, and allowed, you know, said, hey, instead of just parroting back what you've learned, maybe write a poem. A historical fact-based poem, I might have actually, the person that I am, I might have done more research to get at what my thesis was, whereas I was not going to necessarily do that for just parroting back or summarizing an account.
Right.
So I think there is something to the flexibility of poetry and the way it forces you to really choose your words and choose your thesis very, very carefully, that I think makes it a tool that could be used for anything beyond an English class.
Right.
Even mathematics, I think there's, I mean, really, I could nerd out. I mean, I think there's such beauty in numbers, and I think already that they're so lyrical. But I think you could, yeah, I think poetry should be used. It shouldn't be put into this like tiny section of the bookstore. It should be used as a tool for in all classes.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about how much interest might be generated in history and ecology and civics from reading some poems, at least for some young people.
Yeah, and I think it's more digestible than, you know, you have one, maybe two pages. The timelines are three pages long, but you know, in general, they're much smaller than your average history text, but they're chock full.
They are indeed.
And I do have some footnotes, and there is a 20-page bibliography that people can get again from Cornerstone Press if they want.
Nice.
So it is. It does come with quite a bit of research underneath it. And to your, you know, second point, I relied on primary sources when that was available. For instance, the writings from Remembrance Campbell. That was actually his name, Remembrance. I mean, it's amazing. Anyway, news articles, academic articles. I love JSTOR. Shout out to JSTOR for being an excellent resource for folks like me. Evidence given to congressional testimonies, you know, from the 1920s, USDA data on rice production, Department of Energy files on atomic energy blasts, et cetera, in terms of my secondary and tertiary sources. And then I definitely approached it as I would a journalism article and tried to get it verified by the experts, and recognizing I am not the expert. And also to make sure with leaders in different communities and tribal leaders that I was not misrepresenting anything or missing something crucial. So I tried to do that as often as was possible. So yeah, research was definitely a big component to this book.
I mean, you can tell when you're reading it, or I mean, I suppose somebody could make up a lot of facts, but it's so rich and deep. And then when there were things that I thought, oh, I don't know anything about that. Oh, there's a footnote, and I would go read the footnote. So it's just beautifully chock-a-block full of like history and research. But as you said, in this digestible form, is your process iterative? Is it kind of a lot of reading and then a lot of writing? Is it back and forth? Like, what's that like for you?
For this particular kind of poem or collection of poems, I definitely would go down rabbit holes. I had ideas of things that I maybe wanted to explore. I also was very open. Like I had, you know, maybe like three or four for sures that I wanted to tackle in each state. And then I was very open to exploring, you know, I listen in my spare time to podcasts that are, you know, history-based podcasts. And sometimes somebody would just casually say something, and then I would go down and start researching, or a topic that I thought, oh, that's what I really want to cover. And I'd start researching it and then find some side thing that would just lead me down this completely different, much more interesting path. So I was very, very open to where the research was taking me. There were a lot of things that I had no concept of prior to sort of starting to dig through different sources and different ideas. And so in that sense, there was a lot of research. I set up artificial deadlines with myself, though, to try and because I could get lost in research. And so at some point, I had to be like, okay, enough. Now I need to write. Or I would, be taking notes during the research and then see where those notes would take me. But it was often culling down or seeing like what's rising to the top of all this research for this one particular event or person or topic. And sometimes there something would just, appear in my brain and I'd be like, yeah, that's where I'm going to hang it. Like, oh my gosh, what an amazing quote. Just, I'd find a quote from somebody or I'd find, some connection that I had no idea, for instance, that the Sierra Club petitioned the US Geological Naming Group to name a mountain in Southern California after this guy who had been very active in the Sierra Club, Chester Verstig. Well, turns out he had 40 years earlier petitioned Congress to not have the Japanese have or Japanese immigrants and even Japanese born in the United States have the ability to become US citizens or own any land. And the mountain that they chose to petition to name after him overlooks Manzanar, the incarceration camp from World War II of Japanese descendants of Japanese immigrants. And so when I found that, I was like, well, that's the, that ties in all, everything in this most hideous way. And I actually started a petition that went nowhere because I don't know why. I don't know why. It didn't go anywhere. But I did write to the Sierra Club headquarters and Sierra Club chapter that covers that region to petition them to change, to petition for the of an official name change since they were the ones who petitioned for it to be named after him and laid out why, that it should not be named after this man. That was a very long answer. I'm so sorry.
With an excellent and illustrative answer, and I loved every second of it. And I was thinking about it's rough at the Sierra Club right now, I think. They have a lot of problems, a lot of historical problems. They're trying to
Verstig's just the tip of the iceberg.
exactly.
For the reflection of who held power in all sorts of society. Like it wasn't just political power that Well, we'll just leave it at that.
We can turn from history to your style or favorite techniques. I loved a lot of things. You could choose different things to talk about, but one, as I already mentioned, is I love the Liszt poem, both as a teacher and a writer. I mean, there's just something so accessible about a Liszt poem. And so, elastic, it can do a lot of things. And that each section ends with one. You spoke a little bit about this, that they're kind of the most modern ones, but what about the Liszt poem? Is there anything else you love about it? Is there any way you approach it? Is there Why do you like them?
Yeah, I think that they're a different entry into history that we normally don't think about, unless you're, keen on auctions, maybe. But to me, they tell you items, and just naming the item without giving any description to the item, just naming the item can tell you so much about what happened in a space or time. So, and I definitely had some ideas going in. And again, like, you go in with some ideas, and then where the research takes you is always like, what? So for readers who have not read Monarch yet, in California, the list poem is Items Found on Angel Island, which was used, I mean, it had multiple uses over the course of its history, from everything from a place where the Miwok, fished and gathered a variety of food items, to a U.S. Army base, to a transit center for, essentially like an ICE detention center that we would have now. When we started, particularly when we started having Chinese and Japanese exclusion, but Chinese in particular exclusion acts, to now a national park. So you have this really broad, and but just naming the items, you can see all that history without having to explain all that history just by listing the items. And there are archaeologists who set that up for us, as well as many trips to Angel Island, which I would highly recommend to anybody who's coming to the San Francisco Bay Area.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Nevada is the one that gets the most attention because it's items left after Burning Man, and Burning, people think it's going to be a hoot and a holler. And there is a little hooting and hollering, but then there's some other stuff. And Oregon is items that came upon the shore in Oregon after the Japanese tsunami of 2011. And for Washington, I knew I needed to have a Mount St. Helens poem. And it's what was lost, essentially, items found and lost after the eruption, Mount St. Helens. And that one was very shocking to me, I have to say. It's again, you sit there and you think, oh, I kind of know what went down, or I can imagine, but I couldn't imagine. Yeah.
Easy. Let's see. And then I thought a lot about point of view in this collection. I was quite moved by poems that in which you talk from your own point of view about your personal experience of a place, but it's a layer, I would say, of the history of the place. I wonder if you can tell us anything about those poems or about making poems like that.
Yeah, so when I first conceived of the collection, I thought all the poems would have a little bit of my explicit point of view, would have the I explicitly written. Obviously, I'm choosing what I'm writing about. I'm choosing the, how I'm writing about it. So there is my point of view throughout. But then, as I got to writing, I found I didn't have to be there every time. But there were times where the place was so specific to my experience and why I chose to write about that poem that I felt the need to bring the I in. There is one poem where I use the I and it's not me, the persona poem of El Honor de Luis, in which I use the I as if I am Luis Góngora Pat, who was shot and killed by police. He was a immigrant from Mexico who was shot and killed by San Francisco police. And that one was part of a larger project with Clarion, the Clarion Street Mural Project. And it's working with the, it was or inspired, it's an ekphrastic poem in part by the mural that's called El Honor de Luis. But it's also very much because I am who I am, based on a lot of research I did about the incident, not just contemporaneous, like the stuff that was coming out right after it happened, but also for several years after. There were different developments. And then I worked with I talked with the family and their liaison as well, and worked with them to make sure I was capturing correctly things that were important in about his life. So that's the only one where I veer outside of the regular voice for me.
It's really funny to me. I was so caught up in the content and thinking like a teacher, and the more you talk, the more obvious it is to me that how much your experience as a journalist has impacted the work and the poems themselves.
I mean, definitely. This is a very different collection than my collection that came out the year prior, which is more what people would think of as a typical poetry book, I guess. But it was a poetry conversation with an Irish Australian poet named Anne Casey, who's amazing and lovely. And that was called Some Days the Bird. And we did a poem every other week throughout 2021, from the point of view of our gardens. And I did some research for that because I didn't always know so much about what birds I was hearing, or what was I digging my hands, what was the soil kind of like. I got real minuscule because our worlds were minuscule,
Minuscule.
although that we when we conceived of it, we had no concept that that was what was going to happen. We didn't know what 2021 held in store for but so there was some research for that, but it's a much more traditional poetry book. And this one, it does rely quite a bit, happily, for my brain and on my journalism skills.
And as I would say, for me as a reader, it's really lovely.
Well,
I
thank
love
you.
that it's all these things at once. I'm going to ask you one more question, which is a next to closing question, I guess, the penultimate question, really, which is, I do get the pleasure of interviewing a lot of writers, and in my experience, many people have hopes and dreams for books that they send out into the world. Would you say you have some hopes and dreams for Monarch?
Oh, I have big hopes and dreams for Monarch. I want it to
Good.
be a supplement to standard history books, particularly in the four states that I examine. I want it to be something that's used as a starting point for discussions about who gets to write history, whose voices are lost, why we frame communities the way that we have historically framed communities as newly arrived communities when they're in, on the West in particular, where when they're not at all, and how that impacts our relationship with each other. I would love to have it inspire young people and well, people of all ages, but particularly young people, to be more passionate about making sure more voices are included in our understanding of history, and to become more, as a result, civically engaged, which I think brings us all to greater empathy and greater awareness of our connectedness. And I know that's a big ask of a small book of poetry, but I think that when we really learn history, and we're not just memorizing dates and events, but we go in and we see the personal connections, I think it does make us, it can make us more empathetic to each other's realities and hopefully treat each other a little bit better.
Yeah, and I think it's that empathy that really drives committed civic action, that really,
yeah,
feel like if you know better, you should do better.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And if we know that this is where it's this particular trajectory led us in the past,
right,
let's not repeat it.
Exactly.
We're repeating a lot of horrible things right now. And
we're
also carving out some amazing things. And there's some hero stories. It's not just,
yes, that's, you know, right.
There's some hero stories in Monarch. It's not just,
that's right,
bad news.
It isn't. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
So I imagine this conversation has probably convinced a lot of listeners that they need this book. And if they haven't, if it hasn't, I don't know why, but I'll just say you need this book, listeners. So Heather, remind people where they can find it. And because their teachers, also remind them about the other goodies that might be available.
Yeah, so you can find Monarch at your local bookseller. My last name is spelled B as in Bravo, O-U-R, B as in Bravo, E-A-U. It's important because there's lots of Monarchs out there. And if your local bookseller doesn't have it, they can order it for you, or you can get it from any of the online booksellers. You can also get a copy of the teaching guide from my homepage, heatherborbeau.com, or Cornerstone Press's homepage. And they're out of the University of Wisconsin's Stevens Point. But if you want, they have offered to give all educators a free bound copy of the teacher's guide and bibliography. And you would just need to reach out to Cornerstone Press, and you can do that by doing cornerstone.press@uwsp.stevenspoint.edu. A digital version is, again, available on their website or mine.
Heather, it's been an absolute delight both to read your book and to get to talk to you about it. So I really appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. This has been wonderful.
You're listening to NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. NWP. NWP Radio.